You're listening to the Always Forward Leadership Podcast,
featuring the leadership of Ron Kitchens.
The topics discussed today are designed
to keep you moving always forward.
Hey, welcome to the Always Forward Leadership Podcast. We're so excited you're here today. And as always, I'm so excited you're here today, Brad.
Well, I'm actually here with you in person.
We are.
Here in the great city of Kalamazoo.
We are on the campus of Western Michigan University.
Yes, which you are. I feel like I need to announce this because this is a big deal.
Yeah, it is.
A lot of people don't know that you're actually now on the board of...
Trustees. I'm one of 8 trustees for the university.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big deal. Congratulations.
Nice.
And I don't know anything about being a trustee. Your first meeting was when?
This is
fairly recent.
Yeah, so my first meeting was the second week of January.
Oh, okay. So, you know, a month ago.
Yep.
What was the feel, you know, when you walk out of your first ever board of trustee meeting at Western Michigan University? I'm sure that's a microcosm of probably a macro of those kinds of experiences.
Yeah, so I served on lots of boards, both for-profit, not-for-profit, for years. First thing, it's very humbling to be on a university board. It's an 8-year appointment. You're appointed by the governor, and you're the board of directors for the university. You hire and fire the president and set lots of policies, particularly fiscal policy. And so that's very humbling. It's humbling for me when you're, you know, the child of 2 parents who neither one of them attended high school. So both my parents left school in the 8th grade. It's really cool. And then, you know, my passion is to make school accessible, particularly for children of middle and lower middle class families, to make sure, I think the only way out of poverty, the only future our nation has is through education. And so to be able to be part of that, it's really an exciting and humbling experience. It's also a very, very large business. You know, it's 25,000 students and, I don't know, 10,000 employees. So it's a very large business to be part of. So it's going to be a great 8 years.
Yeah. What you said is true, Ron. You served on a lot of boards.
Yeah.
And a lot of leaders who are listening to this probably have a board that they're dealing with. So as somebody who runs an organization that has a board and somebody who's been on a lot of boards, what would be one piece of advice you would give to a board to be more functional and to a leader who has a board to actually serve their board better?
Read the information. You know, I think the first board I was ever on, I was as an elected official. I was at age 21, was elected to city council in my hometown of Ozark, Missouri.
Shout out to the Ozarks.
Shout out to the Ozark Tigers. But I served on the city council for 6 years, and everybody there was 1 or 2 generations older than me, maybe even 3. And I knew the only chance I had to keep up was to do the work. So I read everything, you know, even the documents they tell you, well, you never have to read, you'll never understand them. I read them. And I think as board members, we have a responsibility to read everything provided and to be experts in some of it, to find your passion and be an expert on it. You know, my passion is accessibility. So I'm reading everything I can on what great schools are doing to create accessibility for students. But in university world, they have shared governance, which is a concept I knew nothing about. So I have spent the last 2 months reading everything I can find on the concepts of shared governance and getting to understand that so I can do a good job for that. And then for those serving a board, if you're not working for a board where you're considered to be a peer, you need to change that equation. For me, I both now work for a board, but I also serve on that same board. I have a voice, and they consider me a peer, and in a lot of cases, I'm the leader of the organization, and they're looking to me to lead, not just serve. But I can only do that as long as I have credibility for being honest and intellectually rigorous. So it's really important that young leaders, you got to pay the price. You got to do the work.
Yeah. No, that's good. That's good. Well, congrats again, and I know that's a big honor.
It is.
Being a part of this community, being here in Kalamazoo and Western Michigan is such a huge piece of the equation in this part of the country.
It is, and I'll just put a plug in. We just lowered our out-of-state tuition, so anybody looking for that school,
come on,
please reach out to Ron Kitchens, and we'll get you the appropriate people.
And while we're on the topic, shout out to the University of Oklahoma. my alma mater. And for any, I don't even know who our president is, I should know, but if you're listening, I'm open and willing.
Isn't it David Bourne?
I think it still is David Bourne, yes, who was there when I was in school. So, David, give me a call.
Yeah.
Give me a buzz, buddy.
He was there when I went to graduate school.
Yeah, text me.
There, so.
I forgot about that.
Yeah,
yes.
So we got that going for us.
Absolutely. Well, I'm excited about this guest that you got to sit down with, Scott Belsky, one of the smartest humans alive, in my opinion.
He absolutely is.
And I met Scott probably 9 years ago. He came to Catalyst in Atlanta, and at that time had just started Behance and had just written his book, Making Ideas Happen, and was sort of a new voice that a lot of people didn't know. But Jeff Schoenebarger and I both had discovered him, I think, through 99U
right.
in their conference that they were doing. And, man, talk about a guy that was incredibly impacting to me as a young leader, but also to so many entrepreneurs and free agents and those of us who are kind of out on our own, doing our own thing, and understanding that execution and pushing ideas to completion is probably the most important piece of the equation today.
Yeah, and he was really talking about it before anybody else was. Malcolm Gladwell a little bit was talking about this new trend coming on of, you know, the 1099, the individual entrepreneur building their own craft, the kind of artist as entrepreneur. But Scott has helped thousands do it, more than that, tens of thousands now, with both 99U and with his book, Making It Happen. But, you know, something I really got out of it, and we go kind of deep in the talk, is how to keep your head and your wits about you in this political climate of all this noise out there. And so he gave some great insights, kind of the cognitive cost of allowing the negativity, and whether you agree or disagree with whatever's going on, of just the noise bringing you down and killing your own productivity. And I took a lot out of that from this talk.
It's great. Well, I'm looking forward to listening. So with no further delay, let's listen to your conversation with Scott Belsky.
Hey, Scott, it's great to have you here today. I guess we haven't talked since you were here almost a year ago for Catalyst University.
I know.
Yeah. So tell us what's going on with you.
Well, what's going on with me? I am spending my time between a lot of investing. I'm working with a new company in New York and San Francisco, helping them get off the ground as a sort of co-founder role. And I'm also working on a new writing project that will hopefully be a book someday, chronicling the middle journey, as I like to call it, the stuff in between the start and the finish that makes all the difference that no one likes to talk about.
Absolutely. It's the miserable time. It's always exciting and sexy, and your friends wish you well to launch, and everybody wants to be there at the end when the payout. But nobody ever talks about the hard, lonely nights when you can't sleep because you can't make payroll on Friday.
Exactly.
So on the investing side, what are you looking at? What's really exciting out there?
All kinds of things, whether it's the future of media, whether it's new mobile devices, new applications for live video and things like that. All kinds of different products that interest me these days. So we'll see.
Are you seeing increased volume of opportunities for, you know, there's this kind of perception I hear out there right now that life's good, unemployment rates are low, so there's a dearth of entrepreneurs. I'm not really seeing that, but I'm hearing that from people. Are you still seeing really great, cool, exciting people out there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot of great stuff. And unfortunately, there will always be problems. And where there are problems, there are potential novel solutions. And I don't think it's ever been easier to start a company than it is now.
No, I don't think so. Because today, functionally, you have access to every customer in the world.
Yep.
And, you know, it isn't that you could sell to the four corners of your community. Today, literally, you can take a product to market online, and particularly if it's a technology product, and you could be in customers' hands and go viral in days, not years any longer.
Exactly.
One of the questions I had for you, and we're experiencing, is this idea of mobile workforces. We have an incredible team that we work with, these amazing men and women, but they've got spouses who are beginning to have to relocate for jobs. Instead of saying, hey, I'm going to have to go find a new job in a new town, it's,
hey, let me design my job so I can do the job I have now in a different location. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that there has never been an easier time to also be a mobile team. I have to tell you that I was a very big proponent of teams all working together in the same physical space when I started my business in 2005, 2006. And now I have different advice these days. I've seen some great examples of companies that are part remote or entirely remote. You know, the thing is that they have a culture that really supports it and they use technology that enables it. And, you know, that's more rare. And that's the kind of stuff you have to commit to.
Yeah, and I completely agree. So one of my worries, and one of the things I wanted to ask you about is, you were a natural mentor. You spend a lot of time worrying about the people you work with and building them and understanding that you can't grow unless they grow and are amazing. And on a remote team as a point leader, how do you ensure you're doing a good job on that mentoring coaching piece?
Well, I think that it comes down to, as a manager, empathy, being able to put yourself in the shoes of the people around you. And whether they're in front of you or down the hall, upstairs or across the country, where are their career prospects? What is keeping them up at night? Are they getting the feedback that they need, constructive as well as, you know, rewards? And it's when we lose that. And again, these sorts of things happen within an office, yet alone across the country. But I do believe that leaders that are especially good at it can transcend any sort of geographic boundary. It's really about, are you putting yourself in the shoes of your people? It comes back to like the basic management skill set.
That's great advice, but it's got to be intentional.
It sure does. And also, again, back to the culture piece, do you have a culture where as a leader, you're approachable by others and can they come and talk to you and they feel like they're out of the loop or do they feel like they're losing touch a little bit? Or are you, you know, an organization where there's like free flowing real time communication between people and no one ever feels that way?
One of the things that I think people struggle with is our distance communications and tone. You know, you can't tell the tone of a comment from an email. So how much when somebody is, I don't like the term, but being supervised remotely, how much of that is done digitally versus being on the phone and having just really good conversations?
Well, I think it's about cadence. When you have someone who is a remote worker, your enemy is the out of sight, out of mind principle. And so what can you do to overcome that? And I think that that, you know, it's really about having a cadence of check-ins. A lot of teams that are using Slack, for example, put in a what's called a Slack bot, where there's a channel where everyone every day sort of says what they're doing or shares their goals for the week. And it's an automatic question that everyone gets and answers, and the answers are all transparent. So you're not only accountable to yourself and to your manager, but also to the rest of your colleagues, the people that are dependent upon your work and are or you're dependent on. And those are the types of things, think about it, before Slack, that didn't really happen in a workplace. And sometimes the way it only happened was, I mean, the way we did it was we would have a Monday morning stand-up meeting.
Yep, we do the very same thing.
Sure. So it's the equivalent. And I think that's the answer. It's when you're trying to overcome geographic boundaries, you just have to create practices that make up for, you know, the lack of the visible out of sight, out of mind principles.
I love that. I hadn't even thought of using Slackbot as that technology piece. And Bree, who's in the room with me, our producer, is shaking her head because she's one of those that keeps telling me I could work remotely. It would be just as productive. And I think you may have just helped her change her career trajectory.
Well, so, what I would say is that with remote work, the expectations should go up, not down, because you are, you know, you're working on your own terms. You're free from the FaceTime overhead, and you don't have any more commute. It's really on your own terms. And so in theory, you know, you should be more effective and more reliable. Whereas in the workplace, if you're just down the hall from someone, you never make a case to go up to them and check with them, do you need anything from me? When you're remote, employees should take that upon themselves.
Oh, that's great. It really is a two-way street of accountability.
Right. Yep.
I think that's gold. I really appreciate that. I know it's helped my leadership and I know it's going to help others. But let me change tactics just a little bit. We're having our team meeting this morning and I was talking about we were going to be doing this interview and I, you know, what should I ask Scott about? And several people said, well, I can't believe he's so creative and does such creative, amazing things with his teams and his own leadership, but is also financial driven. And it never dawned on me that some people look at it as either or. And as somebody who's, you know, built conferences around creativity and people delivering, have you heard that before? And what would your response be about this idea that you're either creative or you're not?
Well, I think that the idea that somehow providing for yourself and your team gets in the way of creativity, you know, it's similar to when people would tell me, oh, I'm a creative, so I can't be organized. Like, I want to wear my disorganization as a badge of honor. It's like part of my essence. And it just goes against everything that I have found. I found that the most productive creative people in the world are the most organized. And that organization is an advantage in the creative industry. You know, similarly, I believe that if you don't have an organization that rewards people over time, financially, as well as in other ways, that you're not going to keep the team together. You know, and you're going to get pulled in different directions because at the end of the day, people have families and they have aspirations and goals and, you know, or philanthropic aspirations. You know, they want their hard work to give them more optionality. And when you don't deliver that, people move on. So then the question is, well, how about a nonprofit organization? You know, how does that play out in a nonprofit atmosphere? I think it's a huge challenge in the nonprofit world. A lot of great nonprofit organizations, in terms of their cause, don't retain their people because their people feel like they're not getting the full opportunity that they want to do their greatest work with great people. They feel like there's bureaucracy. They feel like there's slowness and underperformance that's tolerated more than it would be in a for-profit organization. And only a few nonprofits are able to transcend that, whether it's innovative ways of rewarding their people with opportunity or experiential kind of compensation, or just paying their people well. I'm actually one of those few people that thinks nonprofits should pay their people well, because I think that the power of a great top-tier talented person properly incentivized to do the greatest work of their lives for the public good is one of the greatest things ever.
Certainly has more opportunity to have impact over a broader range of people. And I think you're dead on. And when I look at, you know, one of those groups that we study, because we believe exactly what you've said, is, you know, Charity Water. And Scott Harrison has put together a team, and he's competing for the best talent against the best tech firms in the world because his mission is so incredibly important that that's what it takes to succeed.
Absolutely. And if you go to Scott's office, you'll see the environment is one that makes up-and-coming emerging talent feel like they're being stretched, that they have more opportunity perhaps with him than they do with some other startup. And that's one of his secrets of success, I think.
I think you're right. I think he had several thousand applicants for 4 or 5 internship programs. And that just tells you what the street's talking about, not just the mission, but the opportunities that he's giving people as part of that mission.
Yep.
You've built this kind of idea around building a tribe and those opportunities, and whether that's 99U Magazine or 99U the conference, what kind of drove you to focus on this idea? And we see a lot of leaders do this. I don't agree with it, but we see a lot of leaders do this of they think they have a good idea and they've got to hide everything and they're worried somebody's going to steal their best idea. And then I see leaders like you who said, no, 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 come in. I want to show you everything. What's different about your leadership that ignites that fire in you?
Well, I get consumed by problems. When there's a problem and there's a potential solution to it that I just feel must exist, you know, I just say to myself, this has to exist. You know, then I start to perseverate on it. And what I try to do to feed it is I try to, rather than become very passionate about the solution and just go and pursue it, I try to focus on empathy instead. So, and by the way, I feel like some of the most ill-fated startups out there were the result of a group of entrepreneurs that were super passionate about a solution to a problem, but never cared to build empathy for the customer that they were solving it for. And so that means going and actually sitting next to or getting to know the actual people that want your solution, that are suffering from the problem. And in that process, you unearth the insights that will make a great product, in my opinion. Everything from the onboarding, the marketing copy, the go-to-market, the product experience itself, the customer service, the language, the tone of the product, the brand. You know, I think a lot of those insights come from the empathy, not the passion. I mean, is that what you're asking? It's sort of like what kind of galvanizes me? That's really what pulls me in.
I love that, empathy, not the passion. I think that's an amazing tweetable quote there. You know, like you, I work with lots of entrepreneurs and lots of startups and have been guilty of getting great passionate about something and not understanding the problem well enough to truly solve it or truly address it. And I think we see that in, you know, whether it's NGOs trying to solve problems around the world or companies designing new products that are a solution for a problem they don't understand or doesn't exist. And it just wastes lots of resources. When we look at, you know, what inspires you, it's somebody I look to, it's got great ideas, and you're out there doing pretty amazing things, building tribes around you. Where are you getting your inspirational energy from? What are you reading or listening to? Who are you following?
Really, it's people, whether they have an industry expertise or are trying to tackle, you know, a problem on their own. I think I get my energy and inspiration from other entrepreneurs and writers and in stories. So, you know, on the stories front, they don't have to be people I know. They can just be when you hear a unique way that someone's approaching a problem, you know, that's certainly inspiring. So, but it's really the conversations. I love sitting down with someone and I call it jamming, you know, with them a little bit about the problem they're trying to solve and asking them questions and seeing where it goes. And because I find that that process you go through is a proxy for other problems that may be totally unrelated.
You find that in the immediate, you discover the impactful sometimes. And by having those conversations, it unlocks whether those real opportunities are to either have impact in somebody's life or take that conversation to the next level. The political times are crazy right now. There's social unrest. People are looking for others with a platform and a voice. How do you as a leader stay focused on your mission and your consistent voice and not get caught up in the drama of the day? I mean, I see a lot of leaders struggling with this. How do you manage that? Still being knowledgeable, still out there gaining that insight. What's your advice to the young leaders out there listening to us?
It's a really good question, because one of the things I think about a lot these days is the cognitive cost of all of the political drama that's happening right now. Because so much of the conversations that I used to have with people that were about the future and the projects that they're working on and some of the bigger questions that I think both industries as well as society, you know, is trying to grapple with, that I always enjoyed so much. You know, these conversations have pretty much all shifted, at least some percentage of them, to politics. And I always wonder, you know, on the one hand, I understand and support the idea that I mean, we all have to kind of stand for our values. And if we see something that we don't understand, we should talk about it. And I love the idea of patriotism. And at the same way, I also wonder, like, what is the cost? Like, what are the unknown costs? If we have this sort of environment consuming so much of all of our brain power and attention for so long. I remember that stat around how the common cold costs the economy like $8 or $10 or some billion a year, just because people miss a few days of work. And so I'm thinking, okay, well, what's the cost of tuning into the news flow all day, every day, and being consumed by it? And some people can't even sleep and it consumes conversations. I think we have no idea. It's enormous. It's absolutely enormous. And so what I think we need to do is we need to compartmentalize it to some extent. Everyone should act upon their values and find things that are actionable that they can do that make an impact, that help them feel like they're practicing what they preach, so to speak, and doing what they believe. But you also, you know, you just have to sort of compartmentalized, just like any other thing that happens in your life. And because over the very long term, it's these other conversations and these long-term projects that we're all working on that will really change the world as we know it.
I could not have said that better. And I love the idea of a cognitive cost. When we look at where we are now, I think the cost of not living in community, this kind of I disagree with you on one point, so you're now my mortal enemy, doesn't leave the door open for future partnerships, future opportunities. And this echo chamber idea that I can only listen to the news I agree with, or I can not listen to any news at all and decide my opinion is fact.
Right.
leaves us pretty vulnerable to lack of creativity and people coming together. And, you know, I love this mishmash of people. I love Taylor Swift and Def Leppard playing together. You know, these are two people that are not hanging out on the weekends barbecuing, but they make incredibly impactful, kind of cool music together. And if we lose that by losing community, I don't know what those real costs are to the economy, but I know for a fact there are costs.
Yeah. And listen, it's, you know, it's cost to the economy, but it's also cost to culture, and it's cost to the music and everything else that inspires us, you know, over the course of our life. But you know what? You know, you could also, I guess, argue that in times of strife, it also inspires artists, you know, and we saw that in the 60s and the anti-war movement and the music that that spawned. Artists are living and breathing interpreters of what's going on in real time around them. And I remember hearing this Anna Wintour quote. She was interviewed recently for the Wall Street Journal, and they were asking her, like, is there any impact of the sort of the latest political climate on fashion? And she was like, of course, you know, designers don't work in a vacuum. They interpret what goes on around them, and you're going to see that in their clothes or in whatever else they make. So it will definitely impact culture. I just think we have to make sure that we compartmentalize so we still have time to create.
Yeah. And time to live in community with each other.
And yeah.
I think that's one of the things you've done so well is build community. And that's what you've helped us do today by being here. And I can't tell you how much I appreciate both you spending the time with us as well as your leadership and kind of the creative vision that you've brought with that. And so, Scott Belsky, I want to really thank you for being here and being our friend.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great job again, Ron.
Thanks. It's always easy to have conversations with people that are far smarter than you are.
Yeah. Well, and again, Scott is, his book, Making Ideas Happen, it's been out a long time, but I would highly recommend it for any entrepreneur, anyone who is in any kind of leadership position. It's probably one of my top 20 books I've ever read, and it's timeless. It's not one of those that, you know, you read 10 years later after it released and you think, oh, this doesn't make sense anymore. It's still very appropriate for today.
I don't think he talks about pagers or right. Or VCRs.
Fax machines.
Yeah.
Yeah. Blockbuster.
Yeah.
So we do have a copy of his book.
We do.
Because I'm a man of the people.
You are the man of the people when it comes to free swag.
So maybe what we want you to do is tweet your favorite quote or your favorite line from Ron's conversation with Scott. Make sure you use @RonKitchens in that tweet so we can find that. The first one that we see, we will send you a copy of Scott Belsky's book, Making Ideas Happen.
Brad, thanks for being here this week. And thanks to all of you for joining us for the Always Forward Leadership Podcast.
Thanks for joining us for the Always Forward Leadership Podcast. We hope today's insights will help you develop into the leader you dream to be. To subscribe to Ron's blog or to submit a question for Ron to discuss in a future podcast, visit ronkitchens.com or tweet him @ronkitchens.